You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll talk about Fox News and the role it could play in the impeachment inquiry into President Trump. Now, we've all had this kind of problem before, haven't we?
Open the pod bay doors, Hal.
I'm sorry, Dave. I'm afraid I can't do that.
What's the problem?
I think you know what the problem is just as well as I do.
What are you talking about, Hal?
This mission is too important for me to allow you to jeopardize it.
I don't know what you're talking about, Hal.
I know that you and Frank were planning to disconnect me. And I'm afraid that's something I cannot allow to happen.
The artificial intelligence Hal there causing problems for Dave in the 1968 movie 2001 A Space Odyssey. The question of what could happen if machines take over has intrigued and inspired movie makers and science fiction authors, but in general that premise hasn't been a major concern in the development of actual artificial intelligence. That's according to our next guest. He says the way we've been thinking about artificial intelligence has already caused some big problems in society, and we need to rethink what we want from artificial intelligence and how to get it. Stuart Russell is a professor of computer science at the University of California, Berkeley. His new book is called Human Compatible: Artificial Intelligence and the Problem of Control. Stuart, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks, Rob. It's nice to be here.
Well, before we get into the concerns you raise about how we're tackling artificial intelligence, I think just that phrase may conjure up a lot of different images for a lot of people. What do we mean when we're talking about artificial intelligence?
So we mean, how do we make machines intelligent? And I want to be absolutely clear up front. This is nothing spooky. We're not talking about sentience. We're not talking about some spontaneous awakening. There's no Hollywood stuff. It's just intelligence here means acting in such a way that you can expect to achieve your objectives.
And you write that in the artificial intelligence world, the goal has been kind of a one-track goal to make it smarter. And the question of what to do once it got to the point of smartness we wanted to doesn't always cross the minds of a lot of people. Why is that?
It's a great question. I think you know, the issue is what happens if we succeed. We've been trying for 70 years to bring AI to the point where it's as intelligent as human beings or maybe more intelligent. But we never asked what happens if we succeed. And I think one reason for that is it's so incredibly difficult. It's turned out actually to be a lot more difficult than people expected. You know, many famous researchers, you know, even Nobel Prize winners have come a cropper by saying, oh, we're going to have, you know, full AI within 10 years or within 20 years or whatever. So it turns out to be very hard because, in fact, human intelligence is an amazing thing. Our brains are unbelievably well-adapted and incredibly capable. And it just has turned out to be very difficult to get machines to be anything close to the level that humans exhibit, you know, even when they're small children. That may be changing now. So that's one of the reasons why I wrote the book right now.
Yeah, we're still on the road there now at this point. That said, what are the ways that we might interact with artificial intelligence as it exists today in our lives, maybe without being aware of it?
So probably the most pervasive example is on the internet. Whenever you use a search engine, whenever you use social media, whenever you're shopping on Amazon or whatever, there's AI happening all the time. So the search engine itself is, in fact, a big AI system that tries to figure out what your query is about and what you would most like to see in response to your query. And if you're shopping, you know, they can make tons more money if they can figure out what you really might want to buy and send you ads for that or recommendations for that. So that's the biggest money-making side of AI. I think the most obvious one that's coming down the pipe is the self-driving car. I think when those are widespread, it'll be so much in your face, you won't be able to ignore it.
Talking to Stuart Russell, computer science professor at the University of California, Berkeley. His new book is called Human Compatible: Artificial Intelligence and the Problem of Control. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts and your questions for our guest. Stuart, you write, and the recurring theme in your book is that we have to think about the goals we have for artificial intelligence and how, no matter how well-intentioned we are, that artificial intelligence might misconstrue what we want out of it or the consequences of getting there. Could you spell that out for us?
Yeah, so pretty much every AI system that's ever been built is built on the same principle, which is that we supply the objective, and then the algorithm figures out the best way to achieve the objective. So, you know, when you go on your phone, you say, you know, I want to get to the airport. Tell me how to get there. It takes that as the objective, and then it tells you, okay, here's the right sequence of actions to get to the airport. So it's a very natural form of interaction, but it's subject to a very basic problem, which is what happens if you specify the objective incorrectly? And we've known about this for thousands of years. You know, King Midas said, I want everything I touch to turn to gold, and then he got exactly what he asked for. That included his food and his drink and his family. And, of course, he dies in misery and starvation. You know, if you ask a genie, please can you grant me three wishes, you know, what is the third wish in those stories? It's always, please undo the first two wishes because I got them wrong. So that's the nature of the problem. We're creating this sort of engineering technology that only works correctly if you, the human, are absolutely perfect at supplying the one thing it needs, which is the objective.
Yeah, you give a lot.
That's a really bad idea.
You give a lot of concrete examples of how this could go wrong. And one, getting to that self-driving car, if you say, I think the example that you give in the book is, get me to the airport as quickly as possible. We mean one very particular thing like that. How could that be misconstrued if we haven't laid out our algorithms properly?
Well, yeah. So when we say as quickly as possible, we don't just mean that, right? We mean a whole bunch of other things that we normally don't have to say to a human taxi driver, like don't crash, don't get a ticket, don't get arrested, don't kill anybody. So between humans, many parts of our objectives are shared, and so we don't state them all the time. And so we're used to giving these very partial instructions like, you know, I'm late for my flight, please hurry up. But for a machine, it may not have all that additional common sense background. So it might drive at 200 miles an hour. You know, it might, you know, when it gets to that big scrum of cars at the drop-off point, it may sort of just shove the other cars out of the way so it can get you to the drop-off point as quickly as possible. So these are obviously not the behaviors you want, but those are the behaviors that follow as the solution to the objective if you state it incorrectly.
And you say maybe we need to step back and rethink our fundamentals so we avoid that scenario we just laid out and literally thousands of others. How do we need to go back to square one in our thinking about artificial intelligence?
So I should say this is a serious problem, not just for future AI systems, but actually for existing ones. The biggest problem I think we have right now is social media algorithms that have one objective in mind, which is basically to monetize you, the user, as much as possible. So maximizing click-through or other measures of your eyeballs being glued to the screen. And as a result, they've learned to manipulate human beings to be both addicted and extremely predictable. So they turn people into extremists, not because they want them to be extremists, but because extremists are predictable and therefore they can generate more cash from you. So this is a problem already. And when you ask the social media companies, well, you know, why did you create this super powerful platform with it, which has this objective, which is really wrong, right, which is messing up our democracy and international relations and everything else, they said, oh, we made a mistake. And the question is, how do you fix this mistake? And I think the answer is we can't build our systems on the assumption that humans can supply correct objectives. So the system has to know that it doesn't know what the true objective is, that whatever information we've supplied is partial, possibly incorrect. So we want it to be more like a perfect butler than a genie from the lamp that takes your wishes as its command. The perfect butler knows that maybe you've had a couple too many to drink. There's a bunch of things that you forgot. The butler also knows a whole lot about you and your preferences that you usually forget to mention, but he can fill in the gaps. And when it's not sure, when there's anything that needs to be done that might affect a piece of the world that the system is not sure whether it's okay to mess with, then it ought to be asking permission. So if you say to a climate control system, okay, let's restore carbon dioxide back to pre-industrial levels. That sounds like a great objective. We'd all like that to happen, get our climate in balance. But the easiest way to do that is to get rid of all the people, because they're the ones making the carbon dioxide. So the first thing that system should do is to say, well, okay, the obvious plan is to get rid of all the people. Would that be all right? And you should say, well, no, of course not. But, you know, then the second plan is, well, instead of getting rid of all the people, we just gradually, through social engineering, convince them not to have any children so that the human race dies out in the next 60 or 70 years. And is that okay? And again, you should say, no, that's not all right. And then you realize, actually, no, there's a whole lot of stuff I'm leaving out. So the system, by being sort of humble with respect to its understanding of the objective, is always going to be differential to the human, because the human is the one who has the objectives, and the machine knows that it doesn't really know what they are.
We're talking to University of California, Berkeley computer science professor Stuart Russell. His new book is called Human Compatible: Artificial Intelligence and the Problem of Control. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have for our guest about artificial intelligence? What positive or negative experiences have you had with AI? What do you think about the ones you might interact with on a regular basis, as he was mentioning, the things that your social media feeds might present for your perusal? Do you work in artificial intelligence in some way? Love to hear from you. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation about artificial intelligence with computer science professor Stuart Russell. His new book is called Human Compatible: Artificial Intelligence and the Problem of Control. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think about what you're hearing from our guest about the limitations, the concerns about artificial intelligence, the way we're using them now and might use them in the future? What questions do you have for our guest about how all this could work for our benefit, could hurt us one way or the other? Has artificial intelligence impacted your life? Is it part of your job in some way? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll bring on a caller now. Lou is with us in Oregon. Lou, hi.
Yes, hi. Good afternoon. Thanks for taking my call. First-time caller, long-time listener. My question is in regards to the story I read several months back in which Google and Facebook set up a computer network between two AI machines. And in the course of this experiment, the machines started created their own language, and the program was quickly shut down. So I'd like to get your thoughts on the rise of the machines and whether this could lead to, you know, AI machines talking to each other, creating nefarious initiatives.
Lou, thanks for that call. I dimly remember reading something about that. Stuart, is it closer to the front of your mind than mine?
Yeah, I mean, it was to some extent a real story, although I think the media blew it a little bit out of proportion, as occasionally happens.
It happens.
But this is actually, this is something that people have been studying for decades, is how does language emerge? And one way you can study it is actually to put two entities into a little simulated environment in such a way that it's set up for them to gain some advantage from communicating with each other. And they can communicate, you know, by, you know, leaving a stone in a particular place, or, you know, by opening a door or closing a door, or marking something on a sort of a virtual piece of paper. Or by, you know, if you set it up with a direct channel between them, then they can just send ones and zeros. And the code that they invent can be pretty much arbitrary. As long as they come to an agreement about what it means, they can benefit by, for example, collaborating on some tasks by saying, okay, you take one end of the sofa and I'll take the other end of the sofa, for example. So this has been around for decades. I don't think there was any risk that the machines were, you know, going to wake up and become conscious and start plotting something. But it does point to one of the issues with some approaches to building AI. There's an approach called evolutionary computation, where we just specify who gets to live and die in some giant simulation, and then we have an evolutionary process which basically operates on the programs, the algorithms that the machines run, and messes around with them in the hope that eventually, just as happened in biological evolution, the machines become more intelligent. And that's a recipe for creating systems that you do not understand how they work. And in particular, they could develop in the process internal objectives that aren't even aligned with the definition of fitness in the environment. Just like, for example, in the real world, drug addicts develop incentives that aren't really aligned with staying alive and reproducing. It's just one of those accidents of evolution in the interaction of life with the environment. So I wouldn't recommend artificial evolution or another approach that creates black boxes is to essentially try to copy the human brain by, you know, finding a dead person's brain, slicing it up, making a detailed copy neuron by neuron of the entire system. You don't know how that person's brain works. So making a machine that way is a recipe for having a very unpredictable system.
Lou, thanks for that call. We're talking to Stuart Russell. His new book is Human Compatible, Artificial Intelligence and the Problem of Control. Got an email from Denise who says AI algorithms absolutely boot out older working age Americans and do not allow for job applications. They screen for age, worried about the impact of algorithms on job applications. And Stuart, this is a concern that comes up a lot, that people create algorithms and then look at algorithms as these objective measures of job qualifications, risk of committing crimes, again, for people in the court system, things like that. How important is what we put into these artificial intelligences? Not that they're malevolent, but they just recreate our biases.
Yeah, so there's two ways that this happens. One is that the algorithm designers themselves have some ulterior motive in the way they design the system. But I think that's not the problem. At least I hope that's not the problem. The problem is that the data from which the algorithms are trained reflect the biases of society. If you're browsing around on the web, you know, quite often on a lot of websites, you see adverts for jobs that you could apply for. And you might not know it, but that ad is very carefully selected for what the machine has learned about you, about your age, your ethnic group, where you live, what kinds of things you type into the search engine, where you browse. It tracks your cell phone to know where you go. So it has a massive amount of information. And the connection between that and what jobs you're interested in really reflects the historical biases of society as to which people end up being allowed to have which kinds of jobs. And that bias is so pervasive that if you're an African-American browsing on the web, you will often see things for, bail bonds, maybe jobs for security guards or bus drivers, or possibly joining the military, which are traditionally, occupations that have been open to African-Americans. And you won't see ads for, being an accountant, being, CTO of a tech corporation, and so on. And this is extremely unfair and actually exacerbates the problem that we would like to fix. So a lot of AI companies now have become aware of this, I would say a little bit reluctantly, because they don't like to be told that they're actually part of the problem. But I think they are on board now with trying to solve it. And there are technical solutions that can actually produce fair outcomes even from biased data sets. The tricky part is that those fair outcomes, because they no longer reflect the historical data, may not be quite as accurate as an algorithm that is just reflecting the historical data. And so one issue that we don't have a resolution for yet is who's going to pay for that inaccuracy. If it's a loan company that's issuing loans that may get a slightly lower repayment rate than they would like, who pays for that? Is it the other customers, or should it be the government that pays a kind of a subsidy to rectify these historical inequalities?
Let's go back to our callers now. Lee is with us in Milwaukee. Lee, hello.
Thank you for taking my call. I find the subject fascinating, and I have a question or a concern. It's the AI development programmers in limiting the AI's intelligence. so that the AIs aren't necessarily walking around figuring things out more, being, you know, more intelligent than the general population. I just foresee that it could be an issue. And I was wondering if there's any controls being developed for AI intelligence to kind of keep them under wraps or
Interesting.
Keep it under reins.
Stuart, will we hit a point where we need to put the brakes on artificial intelligence and how intelligent it is?
Well, let me give you an analogy, right? Suppose that a whole bunch of corporations were working to develop nuclear energy. And so this would be back, I guess, in the 1930s, 1940s. They figured out how to generate a nuclear chain reaction, but they hadn't yet figured out how to control it so that it didn't blow up. So would you let those corporations go ahead and start creating these nuclear chain reactions that were uncontrolled? No, of course not. You'd say, wait, you don't get to do anything until you solve the control problem. So what I'm arguing is, you know, as AI races forward, there may come a point where if we haven't solved the control problem, then we need to stop. We need to basically, I don't think you can put a ban on research, but you can put a ban on deployment, on what can be actually connected to the internet, what can be sold as a product, what can be let loose in the wild. So you would have to stop, because the negative consequences of putting a much more intelligent than human system out in the world are really without, you know, there's no bottom limit on how bad things could be. So what I'm advocating is, in fact, that we work very hard to solve this control problem, because the benefits of AI are potentially enormous, but we won't get those benefits if we don't solve the control problem, just as we lost the benefits of nuclear power because of Chernobyl and Fukushima.
It's a good place to leave it. Stuart, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you. It's been a delight.
That's Stuart Russell, professor of computer science at the University of California, Berkeley. We've been talking about his new book, Human Compatible: Artificial Intelligence and the Problem of Control. Coming up, as impeachment inquiries ramp up, one media organization remains mostly in the president's corner, Fox News. We'll talk about the origins of the network and the role it could play in the coming year. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow after 6 on The Morning Show, fall produce is the best produce. Fact check. True, according to me. But how do we make it all last? Kate Archer-Kent talks to an expert on food preservation and canning, and you can join in with your advice and questions. That's tomorrow morning at 6 on The Morning Show. Now, it's no secret that President Trump and Fox News are pretty heavily linked. Many of the Fox News personalities have openly supported the president and defended him against critics. Some, like Sean Hannity, have even spoken at his political rallies. And President Trump frequently appears on the network and retweets flattering Fox stories to his million-plus followers. Now the president is facing an impeachment inquiry led by House Democrats. Fox News has followed it closely. Here's an exchange between Fox News host Sean Hannity and analyst Geraldo Rivera.
You know, Geraldo, what did you say? We've never had a president that's had more snakes, backstabbers, knives in his back. I mean, you can give the exact quote, but pretty much you were dead on accurate. They're out to destroy this man. They have been from day one, and they're willing to lie again to accomplish this.
You know, if it wasn't your show, Sean, they would destroy him absolutely. You're the difference between Donald J. Trump and Richard Nixon. In Nixon's case, if he had someone that stuck up for him, he wouldn't have been, motivated to cover up that burglary. He would have let the perpetrators get their just desserts.
I don't necessarily agree with your analysis, but I will tell you, they lie. I'm sick of it.
Kathleen Bartson-Culver is an associate professor in the Department of Journalism and the James E. Burgess Chair of the Center for Journalism Ethics at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Katie, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, that exchange there, and I've heard other people suggest this idea that if Richard Nixon had had Fox News, or at least some parts of it, things might have come out very differently. What kind of thoughts do you have as people make that comparison?
Well, I think Richard Nixon didn't have any of the media environment that we have. So he didn't have, you know, combative talk radio. He didn't have Fox News. But he also didn't have people able to use channels to challenge him from his opponent's side either. So we're in sort of this Wild West digital media environment where you may have a strong voice like Fox News, but you also have other voices in the environment as well. So I'm not sure Nixon would have loved this environment.
And people have pointed toward Roger Ailes, who had worked with Nixon and coached him on TV and then gone on to have a key role in Fox News later on. Is it fair for people to connect the dots between the two?
Sure. I think a lot of people look back to the Nixon administration and think about what might have gone differently had the media environment been different. They also think about the political environment, whether the party was in lockstep in supporting the president. That's a lesson learned as well.
Now, there's Fox News. People also point toward, you've got also MSNBC that has a more liberal perspective. Supporters of the president say, hold on, CNN is taking an anti-Trump role. Is there anything unique, as you see it, about the Fox News channel in particular?
I think the dedication of Fox's following, so the number of people for whom that is a sole news source, that outpaces both CNN and MSNBC. So people who are sort of brand loyal to Fox may be getting a greater share of their information from a single outlet than people who are brand loyal to either of the other two. They're more likely to have a mixed media diet than Fox News viewers are.
And we mentioned the unique relationship between President Trump and Fox News, where he'll call in and talk on one of their shows. He'll retweet. The president will retweet things he's seen on Fox or even type out quotes and chyrons from Fox. Have we seen anything like this in recent memory, that closer relationship between a president and a particular media outlet?
No, we haven't. We saw President Obama do some things to go around news media using his own channels and entertainment channels to try to reach audiences, particularly younger audiences. But we've never seen, at least in my lifetime, this kind of alignment between a president and a particular news outlet. Certainly if we go back to, kind of the heady political journalism or partisan journalism days in earlier centuries, you might have seen this, but I doubt it has the impact that we're seeing here.
Talking to Kathleen Barton Culver from UW-Madison, director of the center, the chair at the Center for Journalism Ethics there, looking at the role of Fox News and modern day politics. We have this impeachment inquiry going, not unique, but darn near unique in American history. What are you watching for in the media reaction, the Fox News reaction to this ongoing inquiry?
I'm very interested in that idea of party solidarity, whether, what happened to Nixon ultimately was not the media turning on him in some way. That constant scrutiny ultimately led to some powerful Republicans saying it was time for the president to think about his legacy and about the party's ability to continue on past him. So I think what's going to be interesting to watch is the extent to which other Republicans begin to challenge President Trump, if they do, and how Fox reacts to that, whether this is a channel that is aligned with a president, aligned with a party, or an independent outlet of its own that's going to challenge all of the above.
Now, there are opinion hosts on Fox News Channel like Sean Hannity, and then news anchors like Shepard Smith, and sometimes there have been clashes between people like Smith and Tucker Carlson. Now, Shepard Smith, this is another reason we wanted to talk about Fox News, one of their daytime news hosts, stepped down from his post, what people saw kind of abruptly last week. Here is him signing off for the last time.
It's been an honor and my pleasure. Even in our currently polarized nation, it's my hope that the facts will win the day, that the truth will always matter, that journalism and journalists will thrive. I'm Shepard Smith, Fox News, New York.
This seemed to catch some of his colleagues by surprise. After a pause, here's Neil Cavuto, who was on immediately after that announcement that Shepard Smith was leaving.
Whoa. I'm Neil Cavuto, and like you, I'm a little stunned and a little heartbroken. I don't know what to say. Shepard Smith, as I said just a few days ago on this very network, a decent human being, a heart as big as Texas, I didn't say Texas at the time, maybe just all of Manhattan. I don't know. A better newsman you probably cannot find.
What do you make of the departure of Shepard Smith from Fox?
I was shocked. I was shocked by the departure. And I think this is something that a lot of people miss when they are talking about Fox News, or when people on the left are complaining about Fox News. So there was a very significant difference between what audiences were getting during the day from Fox News versus the sort of opinion parts at night. And, you know, Shepard Smith was quite challenging of this administration and the Obama administration and the Bush administration before it. You know, he brought a lot to that anchor role, a lot of skepticism. So I don't want to read more into his departure than he offered during the departure, during that final note. I don't want to guess at his motives, but it certainly was a stunner for me.
And there's often this tension between the news side of an outlet and the editorial side, often in newspaper form, places like the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal. Does the public distinguish, do we make that distinction when we read or watch between the news and the editorial side?
No. Most research shows that, no, we are not very good at making that distinction. And I think it's particularly problematic now when so much of it is shared with us on social channels. So when something is coming to you completely stripped of the environment in which it was published, how is the average person to decide whether this is something that's aimed at being neutral or something that's trying to persuade you?
Do we need in the media to do a better job of highlighting, okay, this part here, this is our reporting, this part here, this is opinion?
I think so, because a lot of people inside of news organizations think, oh, we'll label this analysis, and people will know that that means it's got some level of interpretation in it. But I think if you walked out on the street and asked 10 people if they knew what that meant, you'd maybe find one who did.
On the opinion side of things, is it inherently bad if you've got a news outlet that's taking a political stance, a consistent political stance? Is that in any way harmful to our democracy?
It depends on how they're taking that stance. So, you know, it's everything's a matter of degrees. So for an outlet to, you know, align with a particular ideology, I don't think is necessarily destructive. But if they are, you know, twisting facts, if they are leaving out evidence, if they are, you know, purposely putting out misinformation, then that does become problematic. It's you know, how hard you're swinging the bat.
Talking to Kathleen Bartson-Culver. She's an associate professor in the Department of Journalism and the James E. Burgess Chair of the Center for Journalism Ethics at UW-Madison. She's with us to talk about Fox News, its origins, the role it could potentially play in the impeachment inquiry. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of Fox News? Do you love to watch it? Do you love to hate watch it? Do you agree with the way they've covered President Trump, the way they covered President Obama before that? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we continue our conversation about Fox News and the Trump presidency in the midst of the impeachment inquiry. Our guest is Kathleen Bartson-Culver. She's with UW-Madison Department of Journalism, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think about media coverage in general of possible of the ongoing impeachment inquiry? How would you like to see the issue covered? What are your thoughts on Fox News and what they're doing in the era of President Trump? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Let's go to a caller now. Charlie is with us in Milwaukee. Charlie, hi.
Hi, thanks for the call. I like to watch not only Fox News, but also MSNBC and CNN to try and get a wide spectrum of viewpoints to try and get to somewhat of a truthful picture of what's going on. But my question for your guest would be, doesn't it seem that a news media, either right or left, needs to picture itself or give stories for its audience so that it remains profitable, and they will cover certain stories but not others for the audience to be more engaged in? And this can be dangerous. For an example, is that if they didn't cover Lois Lerner or the fact of Hillary Clinton's destruction of emails, that by one news media, they also then won't believe them about Trump, and if he took money from Russia, how that should definitely impinge on his impeachment inquiry.
Charlie, thanks for the call a lot there. Katie, where do you want to go with it?
Well, first of all, I want a lot of people to be like Charlie. I want a lot of people to consume across a spectrum of different news media. He's to be congratulated. And I think that that's a problem that a lot of us have developed, particularly over the last 10, 15 years, is going to news sources that reinforce our own worldviews. So, you know, I may be leading with my chin here saying this to a public radio outlet, but if your only diet, if the only thing you're dieting on is NPR, that is not enough of a feast. You need to diversify and get a healthy your news diet. But I also agree with Charlie that it can be problematic when a news outlet exercises editorial judgment in deciding what to cover and not cover. Audiences can say that that affects their the credibility of that news outlet. So if you believe strongly that the Hillary email story wasn't covered enough, then you're going to say, well, why would I believe this Ukraine reporting now? Because they didn't cover that. But I also think we're all, as news consumers, bringing some motivated reasoning to that. We're making these judgments based on what we want to see happen, and we can feel bias where bias may not actually be present.
Charlie, thanks for the call. Jeff joins us now in Superior. Jeff, hi.
Hi, thank you. I'm old enough to remember John Chancellor and other journalists from years ago who did give editorial comment, but actually said it was their editorial comment. And what concerns me about nowadays is you have editorial comment presented as reporting. And, for example, on Fox News, Sean Hannity has said that the fake dossier was based on false, uncorroborated information and that there is actually corruption, more corruption, that needs to be investigated in Hillary Clinton's campaign. But CNN and MSNBC won't cover that because they're biased for the Democrats. And I wish that Wisconsin Public Radio would present more of a Republican point of view, too, because Wisconsin voted for Trump.
Jeff, thanks for the call. Katie?
Yeah, I think Sean Hannity, if he were on this call, would be the first person to say he doesn't consider himself a journalist. He does consider himself in the realm of opinion, so he doesn't strive for neutral reporting. And that's where you might see a difference between what he puts out and what other news outlets try to put out, is that they are trying to not take a political position. Now, again, if I am, you know, strongly conservative or strongly liberal, I can look at something neutral and see it as hostile to my viewpoint. It's this thing called the hostile media effect that I sort of wish we would teach people about when they're in grade school, to say part of media literacy is understanding the perspective you're bringing when you consume a text. So if I'm a super strong conservative and I read a story about a budget, I might see that as hostile to my viewpoints or where I want spending to go, even though the reporter is actually trying to put out a neutral analysis of the budget.
Thanks a lot for that call. Some people raise concerns about, okay, if you're saying we pay attention to both sides and that balances it out. And then with Sean Hannity in particular, people point to him kind of sticking with the Seth Rich conspiracy theory, for example, kind of long after everybody else had thought it was debunked. If we go with both sides, do we risk going into some of these Warrens where things just, we know they aren't true?
Right. I think both sidesism is quite dangerous. First of all, there aren't, you know, just two sides to everything. It sets up this false binary that there's a liberal side and a conservative side. But actually, we all know as we live our daily lives that things are much, much, much more nuanced than that. You know, if you take, for instance, soybean farming and the trade war, there's really not a left side and a right side. It's a much more difficult, thorny, complex situation. So I think we do ourselves damage when we set up this conversation about news as being this binary, that it's either coming from the left or coming from the right. What we all need is a set of information, an array of information, some of it journalistic, some of it opinionated, to help us make decisions about trade policy and about healthcare and all the other things that matter to us as citizens.
Talking to Kathleen Barton-Culver from UW-Madison, looking at news coverage, the impeachment inquiry, and the role of Fox News. Back to your calls now. Jay is with us in Seneca. Jay, hi.
Hi.
What'd you want to bring up, Jay?
Well, I watch Fox News every now and then, particularly when there are interesting issues going on, just to hear what they have to say. And I find myself turning it off a little bit too quickly sometimes because I get so irritated with how a lot of what I'm hearing is so different than what I'm reading and hearing otherwise. I can't stand it.
Jay, thanks a lot for the call. Katie, a lot of people tune in. They love Fox News, and it clearly drives a part of the market away from them at the same time.
Right. I think they have a very strong, loyal following. They are clearly the ratings winner, but there are other people that turn away from it. And I think that's an interesting part of this impeachment inquiry, something that we're going to want to watch, is how that following changes, either grows or shrinks, based on how the network covers the impeachment inquiry. We've now gone in public opinion polling, including Fox's own polling, into a very small but definite majority of Americans approving of the inquiry. Not, let's be careful with language, not going on to an impeachment, but just proceeding with the inquiry. So if, as you have more of the audience being open to that inquiry, the question is whether Fox is going to be more open to that inquiry.
Thanks a lot for that call, Jay. As someone who works at an ethics and journalism center, what kind of ethical concerns should journalists keep in mind if they know they're working for a network that people view as aligned with one team, a political team or another?
And again, I want to be really careful because there are journalists there who are doing, you know, straight up neutral reporting, particularly on issues involving the economy, for instance. You're not seeing you're seeing more neutral reporting there than you might hear on the Tucker Carlson show or from Sean Hannity. So I want to be really careful about the nuance here and not paint with too broad a brush. I think ethically, we all have to be concerned about the impact of news media on citizens in a democracy, because that's what journalism is supposed to be about. It's supposed to empower all of us to hold our leaders accountable. So if we are turning to news sources to get information to make those judgments, those news sources have a responsibility to us. But then we, in turn, have a responsibility going the other direction. We have a responsibility to consume more than just one news outlet.
Do you worry that there's a problem with us as news consumers that we view ourselves as part of a team very often and excuse me, and we'll seek out the journalism that supports that viewpoint?
I think actually the opposite is true, that we are part of a team, but we don't see it. That we think our worldview is the right worldview, and we reinforce that with the information we consume, but we're not questioning or skeptical enough of ourselves. Because really, honestly, it feels good when you're consuming content that tells you that you're right. You know, you're correct about all of these things. Who doesn't want to feel right all the time? But if we're talking about, you know, being the people who are ultimately in power in a democracy, so being citizens who need to hold our leaders to account, that means being well-informed. And having a really shallow news diet makes us not informed.
So leave us with some news consumer advice, if you would, Katie.
Well, leave you with some news consumer advice. Vary your diet. If there's something that you really think is not worth your time, try it for 5 minutes. Turn it on like Jeff or Charlie do, and see what you can get out of it, if anything. And then open your mind. Open your mind to other things that challenge your views, because ultimately that's the only thing that's going to help us progress. That's the only thing that's going to move us forward.
Katie, thanks a lot for joining us again today.
Absolutely. Happy to do it anytime.
That's Kathleen Bartson-Culver, Associate Professor in the Department of Journalism and the James E. Burgess Chair in Journalism Ethics at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. She joined us today to talk about Fox News, its relationship with the Trump administration, and the role it could play during the impeachment inquiry and wider issues of political coverage in our current media landscape. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, we'll get the latest in ongoing congressional testimony and other big stories from the nation's capital in our weekly roundup of national politics. There's been a lot of flooding in Wisconsin in recent years. We'll look at a new WisContext report on the impact of wetlands and how they can help prevent some of the worst damage from the bigger rainstorms. And some cities are banning new drive-up windows at fast food restaurants to cut emissions and make pedestrians safer, among other things. We'll hear the arguments for and against the drive-through moratoriums. That and more all coming up tomorrow here on Central Time.